This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. A faster permafrost thaw means even the worst scenarios underestimated the pace and severity of climate change. Canadian scientist Merit Turetsky explains abrupt permafrost thaw. Then from Princeton, atmospheric scientist Jane Baldwin, back-to-back heat waves are in your future. In that second interview, you will hear how we will experience repeating heat waves more often as the world warms. You get no chance to recover, really. That can affect global agriculture as well. We already have crop failure or smaller planting in many parts of the world. Due to drought, major producer Australia is importing wheat for the first time in 12 years. Floods have left over 1 million acres of crops partly or wholly destroyed in Argentina, another major international grain source. You may have heard about the crop failure in North Korea, bringing back extreme hunger there. Some Canadian farmers have been unable to plant due to floods or lost winter crops due to extreme and unstable weather this year. It's not a good year for Canadian farmers. I've already covered major flooding damage to grain storage and fields in the Midwestern United States, combined with the tariff war, where China has canceled all soybean purchases from the U.S., and India stopped importing American lentils. Well, countless farmers are not planting and probably not staying in business. Long periods of extreme heat are predicted for the Mediterranean this summer, at times moving even into Northern Europe. But there is some better news in Europe, where Greens won more seats in the European Union Parliament voting. Greens came in second in Germany, third in France, and did better in the rest of Northern Europe. European voters are worried, and they want real climate action. Now we're going to hear two lead scientists explain two new ways the climate is changing. Scientists have issued a new warning that greenhouse gas emissions from thawing permafrost in the north could be twice what we thought as the world warms. Scientist Merit Turetsky is the lead author of the article in the journal Nature, Permafrost Collapse is Accelerating Carbon Release, as published April 30, 2019. Merit is Associate Professor and Canada Research Chair, Tier 2, at Canada's Guelph University, and head of the Turetsky Lab. Studying Arctic carbon cycles, northern fires, soils, and peatlands, she is the author or co-author of almost 200 peer-reviewed papers. From Guelph, Ontario, Merit Turetsky, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Well, let's start with some basic facts. How much of the northern hemisphere is frozen year-round?
That's right. So permafrost refers to these soils or earth materials that remain frozen for consecutive years. And we know that it underlies quite a large extent of the northern hemisphere. About one quarter of the landmass in the northern hemisphere is impacted by these permafrost soils. In total, in a country as big as Canada, where I live and work, we think permafrost affects almost 50% of the country. So it's a pretty big landmass being impacted.
I had no idea that half of Canada is frozen.
So, you know, many people, including my family, refer to Canada as a hockey nation, and I beg to differ. I often refer to Canada as a permafrost nation. It's such an important part of our identity here.
Merit, do we know how much carbon could be contained in that permafrost and how that might compare to our emissions from industrial civilization?
We do. So the science on this issue is extremely important to climate policy. And so, you know, there are many scientists around the world. Many of them are collaborators of mine that are working furiously to improve the science on this. Let me unpack your question because it's a really good one. First, we are getting a better scientific assessment of just how much carbon is stored in these permafrost regions. This is a difficult issue just because the sheer mass of land that we're talking about, and the carbon in these soils has been accumulated over many, many thousands of years. In fact, some of this is from the Pleistocene age. So some of the carbon is actually in, you know, former mammoth biomass. So this is a complicated issue because we have to reconstruct back into time over a very large mass of land. What we know now, our best estimates from the scientific community, is that permafrost soils today stores about twice as much carbon as is contained in the entire atmosphere. So there's this big pool or stock of carbon sitting in these soils, in large part because those soils and materials have been frozen and thus locked away from any kind of decomposition or biological activity, literally in Earth's freezer in the ground. What we need to now understand better is what part of that stock, not going to be all of it, but what fraction of that stock sitting in the ground in the biosphere is going to be released back to the atmosphere when that permafrost thaws. This is the number that is much less constrained. We are working on it feverishly, but the numbers are still hotly debated by scientists. If all of the permafrost carbon is released to the atmosphere, this would be a catastrophic change in greenhouse gas concentrations. We know now today from science that that's not going to happen. Some proportion of permafrost carbon will be released, and the question is, how large will that proportion be? Our best guess is about 20% of the stock of permafrost carbon is vulnerable to release, and it's going to be released over a slow period of time, probably hundreds of years. So this is an emission from thawing ground in the Arctic that is globally significant. It's like adding another large industrial nation to the emission scene, another United States or another China. But permafrost carbon release is still smaller than human emissions. It's certainly smaller today, and it likely will remain smaller than human emissions, at least in the near future.
Why do scientists, if I read this right, on your team warn that greenhouse gas emissions from thawing permafrost could be twice what current models expect?
So right now, very few climate models or large-scale models consider permafrost at all. So there are a number of complicated issues in these large-scale models, but the interactions of permafrost thaw and carbon release are not well represented in any of these models. What that means is when you read about scenarios from the IPCC, for example, or scenarios used by governments around the world, those climate scenarios for the future do not account for potential release of carbon from a thawing Arctic. There are a handful of models that are starting to simulate or project permafrost and start to account for that. And what those models are doing, so these are some of the most cutting-edge models used by climate scientists and by governments and policymakers around the world. But right now, these models are only considering a very simple type of permafrost thaw. And we call this vertical thaw or active layer thickening, and it's when surface permafrost thaws very gradually and very slowly over time, but it happens everywhere in the Arctic. And we know that this is happening from measurements being collected across field sites all around the Arctic, all around the world. But what I work on and what my colleagues research is a different kind of permafrost thaw, and this happens in a smaller area of the Arctic, but it happens very quickly, and it's abrupt permafrost thaw. It happens only when permafrost contains a lot of ice in it. So permafrost can be frozen anything in the ground, frozen rock, frozen sand. And you can imagine in your mind, if frozen rock warms up, it's not really going to have that many consequences. It's not going to affect the ecosystem. It's not really containing any carbon. So there's no big changes happening. But if you thaw and warm up a material that had a lot of ice in it, all of a sudden that water can have really big consequences for the ecosystem. And that's, in fact, what we're seeing. Big areas of forest in ice-rich permafrost terrain thawing out in periods of months to a year, and actually very quickly being converted into lakes. So a forest switches to a lake in a very short period of time. These are kinds of the land cover changes associated with permafrost thaw that have big consequences for carbon release, particularly methane emissions. And up until now, these are not being considered in any kind of large-scale models. So that's where our paper came in. We're updating the estimates of permafrost carbon release to include not only slow and steady thaw occurring all around the Arctic, but these hot spots of abrupt change that are happening in a smaller area of land in ice-rich permafrost, but nonetheless are having big consequences for carbon release on a per meter square basis.
Well, if we were actually up there, there's some crazy things happening. There's some new almost canyons opening up and drunken forests where you have forests falling over and small lakes or ponds appearing across, I know, Siberia, just suddenly a landscape dotted with small little lakes and ponds. Could you talk to us about the unstable nature of frozen lands known as Yadoma?
Absolutely. So Yadoma or Yadoma is a really interesting historical deposit of permafrost, and it's very rich in ice and in carbon. And I guess this is a really important point, and Yadoma soils really drives this point home. Ice-rich permafrost is very vulnerable to these kinds of sudden landscape changes that you've just covered, and it also tends to be associated with high carbon densities. So this is carbon that used to be in the atmosphere, and it was drawn out of the atmosphere by life, living and breathing and respiring and building biomass in the surface of these ecosystems long, long ago. We're talking about Pleistocene grasslands and mammoths roaming those grasslands during the Pleistocene. And those organisms died, and their biomass and its carbon in that biomass was folded into these layers of permafrost. So Yadoma is this old permafrost remnant from this very productive period, almost a grassland steppe type environment in what is now the Arctic, and it contains a lot of carbon. Today, these areas are sitting in pretty poorly drained areas. There's big pockets of Yadoma soils in Siberia, as you mentioned. There's also pockets in other places. For example, Alaska has large regions of Yadoma soils. So we know that these are soils that are very vulnerable. They're currently frozen, but they're starting to experience abrupt thaw at rates faster than what we've seen in the past. And there's a lot of carbon sitting in those soils just waiting to be rotted, literally rotted by microbial communities once those soils warm up. So they're not able to rot now because the temperatures are too cold when the permafrost is in its frozen state. But once it starts to warm up, there's a lot of very yummy carbon for those decomposers, and you know that temperature constraint on decomposition is lifted. We can see high carbon emissions from these areas in two forms of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and also methane.
In 2012, I recorded your co-author Charles Coven's presentation to the American Academy of Science in Vancouver, and then I interviewed Professor Antoni Lukowicz. But my first impression was that in North America, the study of permafrost back then was a relatively small group of scientists. I was the only journalist in the room. It wasn't a hot topic. And that was during the time of Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who had defunded climate change research. Has Arctic research, and particularly into the permafrost, improved in Canada since?
It has. There have been great improvements. There are now networks and groups of scientists both internationally and within the national confines of Canada working together. And that's the key. Researchers who focus on the Arctic work in very remote locations. It's very difficult work to do. We often spend lots of time walking through difficult terrain, hauling equipment through difficult terrain. And so you end up studying patches of land and understanding it really well. And if I can gather my data and combine it with researchers working in other field locations around the Arctic, then we create a network of information that has greater power than the sum of its parts. And that is scientific knowledge generation through synthesis. And that is, in fact, what we are doing. So about 10 years ago or so, I was one of a handful of scientists that formed a group that you probably have heard of called the Permafrost Carbon Network. And we started with a group of colleagues, and Charlie Coven was one of them. And it grew from there. Over the last 10 years, our network has grown to be a group of over 250 scientists. We all work together. And these scientists, these active members of the Permafrost Carbon Network, come from more than 24 countries. So this shows that this issue of permafrost change and permafrost carbon dynamics is of interest far beyond just the Arctic nations alone.
Are Russian scientists involved in this field as well?
They are. Now, there is a long and rich history of measuring permafrost change here in Canada, also in Alaska, also in Russia. Canadian scientists and American scientists tend to publish in the same journals, and obviously English is a language of choice for that work. There's a tremendous amount of useful information that is published in Russian journals in a language that we can access but is difficult for us to access. So that is taking time, but we have many Russian colleagues who are assisting with that, trying to pull as much historical information out of those journals as possible so that we can combine it with what we're collecting today.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. With us is the scientist Merit Turetsky from Canada. She just led a new comment in the journal Nature titled Permafrost Collapse is Accelerating Carbon Release. Merit, why did you and your co-authors think it was important to raise these questions in one of the most prominent scientific journals, Nature?
We felt it was important for a number of reasons. One is sentiment across places like North America on public sentiment on climate change is changing. So more Americans and Canadians in the public today believe that anthropogenic climate change is happening and will affect them in the future than ever before. So we feel that it's our obligation to continue to talk about climate change, to represent northern ecosystems and northern communities. We have the great fortune of working in places that most Canadians and most Americans will never see for themselves. These northern systems are on the front lines of climate change. They are experiencing climate change at rates 3 to 4 times faster than anywhere else on Earth. And we are experiencing that because we see the consequences. It's impacting our data. It's impacting our field infrastructure, our field locations. So we are literally seeing these changes happen before our very eyes. We want to talk about that to the public. Number two, most of the scientific community, even other climate experts, know about permafrost. They know about permafrost thaw, but they may only know about one type of permafrost thaw, that slow and steady, gradual permafrost thaw that is being incorporated into some large-scale models. Few people are aware of these abrupt changes that can occur in ice-rich permafrost. We know these impacts. We study these impacts. We felt it was important to communicate this to the scientific community and also to the IPCC, who are releasing a special report later this year focusing on changing oceans and changing cryosphere dynamics. And certainly permafrost is a big part of the cryosphere. So this is an important time for the IPCC also to be aware of the complexities of permafrost thaw.
Could greenhouse gases from thawing permafrost become a serious positive feedback loop where warming creates more gases that lead to more warming?
It absolutely will. And I think our latest study really reinforces that this will be an important issue to consider in our climate system in the future. And it's funny because scientists use the term positive feedback to represent this self-reinforcing loop where climate change feeds in on itself. And you outlined that self-reinforcing loop quite well. But when the public hears the term positive feedback, they say, hey, it must be good news. It's positive, right? So what scientists really should be doing is describing, not using the term positive feedback, but we need to talk about this as a potential amplifier or a self-reinforcing loop. Again, exactly what you said. We have warming that's causing permafrost to thaw and release ancient carbon to the atmosphere, where that carbon is triggering more warming, which causes more thaw, which causes more release of ancient carbon, and so on and so on. We get into this feedback loop where climate change is reinforcing itself. Our models represent some examples of these self-reinforcing loops, but they do not represent these well in the Arctic, and they certainly do not represent them well when it comes to permafrost. So until our models can project these complexities in the climate system in a more nuanced way, we need to continue to gather data and, you know, empirical information from our observations so that models can start to really understand that behavior. Because models, while no model is perfect and no modeling community would ever claim that our climate models are perfect, they are our only tool, and they are a good tool for making projections of our climate into the future. And in fact, our models have done a pretty good job describing the kinds of climate change that have happened over the last few decades.
In your article, you do talk about some steps that should be taken, and it sounded to me, it kind of reminded me of a military project that happened in the Arctic during the Cold War, which was the construction of the dew line measuring stations to watch for missiles coming over the Arctic. But in this case, you're asking for a major investment in monitoring Arctic emissions. What should be done?
I think there's a number of really important gaps in our understanding. There are just such limited field locations around the Arctic where change is being measured. And when I say change, I mean change in the ground, in the permafrost itself, but also change in the consequences of thaw, which is one of those consequences is carbon release. There are new tools being developed that can use aircraft data and satellite data to help us project carbon emissions. And so we don't necessarily need to be on the ground anymore in different locations in the Arctic to make these measurements. We can use aircraft and other kinds of technology that can gather data over much larger areas more quickly. So these offer a lot of hope for gathering more scientific evidence and information useful for getting these feedbacks and cycle loops into our models. We also need some really basic data. So I often say that the fate of permafrost carbon rests on ground ice. That is a key variable. How much ice is stored in permafrost? It sounds like such a simple variable to measure, and yet it is actually quite a difficult thing to actually quantify because you have to drill down deep into the permafrost to get those measurements. But the military has been collecting ground ice measurements for decades. Construction companies and consulting companies in the north working on pipelines, working on road development in the north, they have been collecting this information to figure out where roads should be placed. We need to get that data, those data, off of the computers of consulting firms, off of old hard drives, out of old filing cabinets. And we need to get those data into the hands of scientists so that we can actually use it to improve our predictions for the North. And this is important not just for understanding carbon and carbon emissions. It's important for understanding how people will live in the Arctic in the future. The Arctic right now is livable because of frozen conditions. People travel across frozen soils. They depend on sea ice. They depend on permafrost as the backbone of their livelihoods. And climate change is taking away those backbones. It's going to require a totally different way of living and building in the north in a life without permafrost and in a life without sea ice.
In other permafrost news, Dr. Yaroslav Obu and colleagues from several countries have just released a new map of permafrost. Have you had a chance to look at that yet?
I have. It's a great new product, and it's one that I know is quickly being assimilated into all sorts of modeling projections, including trying to understand permafrost change, trying to understand its impacts on carbon release, trying to understand its impact on infrastructure. It also speaks to the fact that it's very difficult to make predictions about where permafrost is. And that is step number one. If we want to understand how permafrost is going to change, we need to understand where it is today. And these are really difficult data to come by. So these new advancements are really fine-tuning what had been a previously old data set that everyone was relying on. So these are really good advancements for the entire scientific community.
Merit Turetsky, will you be attending the Arctic Futures 2050 conference in September in Washington?
I hope to. So I am part of SEARCH, which is a U.S. multi-agency funded organization that is helping to drive that workshop and that meeting. I am part of the Permafrost Action Team, and we are going to have exhibits. We are going to have poster presentations, and we will be working with policymakers and other attendees at that meeting to help ensure that our measurements and our ongoing synthesis activities are best taken up by policymakers, because that's the goal. Every scientist wants to have an impact. We want to make sure that our data can be used effectively, not only by the public, but also by policymakers. And so that meeting, I think, will be a really important opportunity for cross-dialogue so that scientists also understand what is needed from policymakers and vice versa, how we can talk about permafrost in a way that can be readily understood by policymakers.
Okay, your Twitter handle is Queen of Peat, and you've participated in numerous studies about Arctic peatlands. Why? What is the attraction of that for you?
By these ecosystems because most people avoid them in the Arctic. Many scientists will walk for kilometers to avoid peatlands because they're very difficult to traverse. They're the kind of ecosystems where you need hip waders and little rubber dinghies to get across. But they are fascinating systems. So these are poorly drained systems that cover much of the Arctic, huge areas of Canada and Siberia and Alaska. The water simply, it's so flat the water can't go anywhere, so it pools up on the landscape. And what we get as a result are these gorgeous wetland habitats. They accumulate these thick layers of peat. And peat is this legacy of carbon, again, that used to be in the atmosphere but has been drawn out largely because of plant growth, plants growing and then dying and being buried and incorporated into this peat layer over time. There's quite a lot of peat that is frozen into permafrost. So not all peat is frozen in permafrost, but a lot of it is. So these two issues overlap with one another conceptually in terms of thinking about carbon that's stockpiled in the biosphere that's vulnerable to climate change that could get re-released to the atmosphere. Not only is peat carbon being thawed out as a result of permafrost change, but it's also burning as a result of drier conditions and warmer conditions and changing wildfire cycles. So our peat in the north has been this really important legacy of old carbon. It's been stockpiled away for hundreds to thousands of years. But because the Arctic is changing so quickly, it's really being barraged by a number of different disturbances, permafrost thaw, wildfire, just drought in general, warmer conditions and drier conditions. And I'm really fascinated by when the past catches up and influences our future. And these truly are legacies of the past.
You left out the horror for me, the bugs, but let's move on.
That's right.
They certainly bite you. Merritt, as we wrap up here, you're also the mother of three. Do you personally worry about your kids' future as the climate shifts?
I do. I live in a region in southern Ontario where we are surrounded by water. And, you know, we don't have a lot of natural disasters and extreme weather events to worry about. And, you know, I think many Canadians feel the same way. We know climate change is happening. We know that there's a human contribution to climate change, and we know things are going to get bad. But we are relatively protected from some of the worst impacts from climate change. And I worry as my children grow and disperse across the country that they will have spent a big chunk of their time in a very naive location. We need to be looking out for our most vulnerable populations. And that includes the North, but it includes other places around the world where, you know, economic class becomes an important issue. Access to clean water becomes an issue. Food insecurity becomes an issue. So for me, climate change is what I study, climate change in the North in particular. But I really feel strongly that this is a social justice issue. Some of our most vulnerable human populations are going to be impacted the first. And in fact, we're already seeing that in the Arctic and in island nations around the world. And that is something that both inspires me and depresses me at the very same time, because we have a chance to act now. My kids believe so strongly in climate change that they make decisions every day about walking to school, biking to school, and they talk about saving the North as a result. And if we can all just have that attitude, if we can all change our behavior in small ways every single day and in big ways by influencing parents and how parents vote, then we maybe can stave off the worst consequences of climate change. But we only have the next few years to do that. And after our window of the next decade, things will simply be too far along in terms of human emissions to roll it back. So if we act now, we have a chance. We can't stave off all climate change impacts, but we can maybe prevent the worst from happening. What I fear the most is that through our inactions today, we are leaving the worst problems to the next generation, and that simply would be a tragedy.
From Canada, we've been speaking with scientist Merritt Turetsky. You can find links to the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Merritt, thank you so much for contributing to our knowledge here on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Are you ready for back-to-back scorching heat waves? Probably not. New research from scientists at Princeton say heat waves are coming strong and closer together as the planet warms. Wherever you live, you are going to feel this. Our guest is the lead author of the new paper, Temporally Compound Heat Wave Events and Global Warming, an Emerging Hazard. Jane Wilson-Baldwin is a postdoctoral research associate with the Princeton Environmental Institute in New Jersey. Jane Baldwin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you here. Now, before we get to what is new, Jane, how do you define the term heat wave?
So I think at its most basic, a heat wave is a period of consecutive, extremely hot days. There are a range of different definitions of heat waves. Some require, you know, at least three hot days in a row. Some require six hot days. But in general, you assign some threshold above which a day is considered extremely hot. And if you have a bunch of extremely hot days in a row, that's what's typically considered a heat wave.
Now, on the topic of your new paper, the popular press talks about back-to-back heat waves, and Northern Europe experienced them in 2018, and multiple close-in-time heat waves hit the Mediterranean the year before that. So we're already getting the kind of events you studied?
Yes, to some degree we are. One of the things we find in the paper, though, is that in the present, only about 10% of heat wave related risk comes from what we call compound heat waves, what the press has been calling back-to-back heat waves. But one of the key results of this paper is that we expect the proportion of heat wave risk that comes from these back-to-back heat waves will significantly increase with global warming.
Your paper suggests extreme temperatures are, quote, among the most deadly of natural disasters. Can you quantify that for us, Jane?
One study I can mention, there was an examination of heat wave related or weather related mortality in the United States, and it found that a plurality of weather related mortality came from heat waves. So definitely other types of extreme weather events, you know, freezing rain or hurricanes, can definitely have a sizable impact on mortality, and particularly if you have a hurricane hitting the Gulf Coast one summer, then for that particular year, hurricane-related mortality might overwhelm weather-related mortality for that year. But on average, heat-related mortality causes about, I think the number is around 30% of weather-related risk in the U.S. Another caveat I should mention is that in places outside the U.S., that number might differ, but unfortunately, detailed mortality data and correspondence with extreme weather events is sometimes hard to come by.
We did have one scientist on Radio EcoShock from Australia who said that heat deaths there had overtaken car deaths as the largest cause of sort of accidental deaths. But it's the sort of thing that sneaks up on you. I mean, we hear about 4 or even 20 people dying in a tornado, and that's a terrible thing. But the heat deaths, you know, seniors and babies kind of drift into hospitals. They may pass away. We don't see the big headlines about it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the most insidious parts of heat waves is that often when a heat wave is occurring, if you read accounts of heat waves, the people living in a city won't even realize that it's killing, that it's such a big risk until someone, I mean, the Chicago heat wave of 1995, famously, the guy who ran the morgue was the one who really said, hey, we have so many people going through the morgue, so many more than usual, there must be something unusual going on. And that's when the city started to put out warnings about the heat wave. But the other thing that is problematic with heat waves is the people who tend to pass away are the elderly, the sick, the alone. They're populations that people sadly often aren't thinking about as much as others. Hurricanes, by contrast, you know, will sweep through an area and affect all sorts of different demographic groups more similarly, it seems.
The environmental group We Act in Harlem, New York, says inner city residents are more vulnerable to recurring heat waves. Can you talk about that?
That's a really interesting piece of work that was done recently. We Act developed a relationship with a bunch of community members in Harlem, and they were able to place sensors within individuals' apartments in a range of different types of apartment buildings, sometimes on upper floors, sometimes on lower floors, sometimes with fans, without fans, with some degree of AC, with no AC. And they tracked temperature within those apartments going in and out of heat waves. And what they found was that if you look at outdoor temperature around a heat wave in New York City, it will go up and then temperature will cool down pretty rapidly once the heat wave ends. But indoor temperature will remain elevated and lag outdoor temperature to some degree. So what that means is if you have two heat waves occurring close together with a cooler break in between, even though it might cool down quite a bit outside, residents inside apartments that aren't air conditioned well might not really see a break between those two heat waves. And this is actually in accounts of people perishing during heat waves. Often they're in their apartment and for whatever reason, they weren't able to open a window and they didn't have a family member to check on them. So sometimes the good thing about heat waves is interventions can be very simple to help deal with them. But again, the situations in which people often die can be pretty tragic, and just, you know, people that live around us that we're just not thinking about as much, perhaps.
Now, that was surely the story in France in the 2003 heat wave that killed somewhere between 30 and 70,000 people in Europe. And there were a lot of seniors who were indoors, nobody to check on them. And some inner city residents are afraid to open their windows because of crime. So you get all kinds of factors work in that can kill people.
Right, definitely. And I've also heard some discussion about sometimes different cultural differences. If people have maybe immigrated from somewhere in the tropics, they might think, well, you know, we never had AC down there, I'll be fine. And you often see that kind of attitude more in also in more elderly populations. So there are all sorts of complex factors that might lead some people to be more vulnerable than others.
Jane Baldwin, you have co-authored several papers on the urban heat island effect. What is that, and does that relate to the returning heat waves in your new paper?
Yeah, so the urban heat island effect is that if we look at cities compared to surrounding rural areas, cities tend to have elevated temperatures compared to surrounding rural areas. There are a few different reasons for this. One reason is that the surface in cities tends to be drier than in surrounding rural areas. And so the city surface can't cool via evaporation, and that results in a hotter surface in cities. There are also other aspects that have to do with energy usage in cities and just insulation and wind flow in general. And also the color of surfaces. Surfaces in cities tend to be dark, and much like if you have a black car that heats up faster than a white car, cities can, as a result, heat up more. So all these factors lead urban places to be hotter on average than surrounding rural places. Now, this is a significant concern, particularly in light of global warming, because we have a increase in temperature that's resulting from increasing carbon emissions. But we also have urban areas that, you know, there's a general trend across the world for people are increasingly moving to urban regions. Urban regions are getting denser and bigger. And as a result, you see a stronger and stronger urban heat island effect. So in the areas where more people are living, they're being struck by a double header of both global warming, increasing temperature, and the urban heat island effect becoming more exacerbated. In our paper, the climate model we were using doesn't differentiate urban versus rural places. So we didn't specifically look at how the urban heat island effect would influence our results. That's actually something, though, we're excited to do in future work. A collaborator who is now at Boston University but used to also be at Princeton developed a module for the climate model I work with that allows you to differentiate these effects of urban versus more rural places. So that's an exciting future direction.
Yeah, there's all sorts of science could come out of your paper. I mean, for example, we know air pollution is killing millions of people around the world already. And I don't know, did you get a chance in your new study to look at the combined effect of smog and back-to-back heat waves?
No, that's an interesting idea. I haven't looked at that specifically. I know that there's a lot of research that looks at how heat waves and air pollution interact, but I haven't thought about it so much in terms of back-to-back heat waves and air pollution.
We do see evidence of residual impacts of heat waves in many places. Studies of trees show they can still be in a heat protective and less productive state as long as 11 days after heat events. So what does your new science tell us about forest and maybe agricultural productivity when there's less chance to recover between one heat wave and the next?
That's a very good question. That's an interesting fact you state about tree recovery from heat waves. I actually hadn't heard that specific statistic before.
I'll send you a link to it. It's about studies in fir trees.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. That would be very helpful. So common models of plant growth often divide temperatures between growing degree days, so temperatures at which plants can grow well, and killing degree days, so temperatures at which the temperature is too high or perhaps too low and the plant will start to die off. And an interesting question, which we've thought about exploring but haven't really had a chance to yet, would be, is there some kind of interaction between when you have multiple hot days in sequence, that it's not just that the temperature on each day leads up to the effects on the plants. If there's some kind of, we'd call it a nonlinearity, but an interaction between the high temperatures on different days that could lead to elevated plant mortality. So in short, we haven't specifically investigated this, but I would expect that there might be problematic interactions where if you have a heat wave early in a plant's growth cycle and then you're struck with another heat wave, the effects of those two might be greater than the sum of the parts of those two events. But we don't have concrete evidence of that yet.
I think another avenue of investigation with recurring heat waves could be about the insects and other species like birds. They've got to be affected when they don't get time to recover from extreme heat. That's another avenue to look at.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting. I'm not sure. So I've talked a fair amount with epidemiologists about how my work connects to human mortality. I haven't talked so much with ecologists, but it would be interesting to know what kind of data they have and what kind of information about bird behavior during extremely hot events. That's an interesting idea. Thanks.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Princeton scientist Dr. Jane Baldwin. We're talking about the developing phenomenon of multiple heat waves hitting one after another. Let's get to your findings. Jane, please take as much time as you need to tell us, have return heat waves increased in the last few decades, and what do models show happening in the future?
I'm not sure the time series of the historical period that we have is long enough to really clearly indicate whether back-to-back heat waves have been increasing. We do see some evidence of an increasing frequency of heat waves with climate change. And so at its most basic, you'd expect if you have more heat waves, then they'd be more likely to occur back-to-back. And so I think in general, that's the case. Now, where it becomes a little more complicated, and this is where a lot of the paper was focused, was when we look at projections of future climate using climate models, so what the world will be like with increasing carbon emissions, we find a much higher proportion of heat wave risk coming from these back-to-back heat waves, these kind of heat wave events that exhibit more complex temporal structures than just one period above extremely hot threshold. So given that we see this change, one question you can ask is, well, can this simply be explained by a increase in mean temperature on average temperatures, or is there something in the climate system that's making heat waves kind of group together more, stick closer to one another, and that could be related to some change in variance, we'd say. And what we find, and this was actually surprising at first, though now, of course, it makes a lot more sense to us now, is that essentially all of the change in these compound heat waves and their pattern that we see with global warming and their increase can be quite simply explained by an increase in mean temperature. This change doesn't require complex changes in how temperature is varying over time. So essentially, if you take weather today and you think about moving up its mean to higher values of temperature, then you start to see an increasing number of these compound heat waves and a greater percentage of heat wave risk coming from these compound heat waves. So our initial reaction to that was, well, that's not a super exciting result then. It's so obvious, and you just increase mean temperature. But I think where this result is really important is when, A, since it's just rooted in the increase in mean temperature, it makes it much more confident that it is a robust result. If it was rooted in some complex change in temperature variability, we'd have a lot less confidence that climate models would be able to project that. So one point is we're confident this is a robust result. The second point is if you look at how heat wave warning systems work today, so these are systems, you know, if you live in a city like New York, for example, if there are, say, 2 days above, I think it's 95 degrees Fahrenheit, the city government issues a notification to weather forecasters and other bodies in the area to put out warnings. So you turn on your TV, you're looking at the weather, and the guy would say, you know, there's a heat wave warning effect, you know, make sure to drink water, stay indoors, et cetera. So right now how these heat wave warning systems work is they look at the next few days of predicted temperature. And I think one of the key implications of this study is going into the future as we see more and more of these compound heat waves, I think it'll be increasingly important to not only consider the predicted weather, but also consider the recent past history of weather when one is deciding whether to issue a heat wave warning. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You also stimulated me to think that another factor has got to be the changes in the waviness of the jet stream and the fact that we have some weather systems stalling over certain areas and some blocking happening. And so if it's really hot where you are, it may stay hot like that for quite a long time. This has happened in northern Australia. It's happened in California last year. And I think that could also be a factor driving recurring heat waves.
So that, when I was talking about changes in the variance of temperature, the variability of temperature, if we were seeing more changes in blocking, more blocking events, greater waviness of the jet stream, that would fall under the category of being a change in variance that was affecting heat waves. Interestingly, though, in the context of the climate model we used, we find that those changes in variance, which could be changes in blocking events, for example, frequency of blocking events, really aren't playing a very big role in this result. That's not to say they aren't playing some role, but they're really not a first-order important effect. Now, an important caveat to that is we were looking at one climate model, which we use because it has particularly high resolution in the atmosphere, meaning it has a lot of spatial detail that's useful for looking at these types of extreme events. But it would be useful to see if this result holds up with other climate models, for example.
Along with your co-author, Gabriel Vecchi, you also specialize in the study of climate and Asian cyclones. We've had some terrible tropical cyclones in the past few years. Can we make any good predictions about what will happen with tropical cyclones as the world warms?
Yeah, that's a million-dollar question. So I think there are some things that we have a fair amount of confidence on with regard to tropical cyclones, and there are some things we have somewhat less confidence on. So there are pretty robust projections that the intensity of tropical cyclones will increase with global warming. So you're seeing more Category 5, for example, hurricanes, as opposed to Category 1 or 2, where the categories are the Saffir-Simpson scale, which is a way of ranking hurricane intensity, how strong the winds are, et cetera. But the thing we're a lot less sure about is how the frequency of tropical cyclones will change with global warming. There's some evidence that we'll have fewer but fiercer, so meaning we'll have stronger but fewer tropical cyclones. But that result, actually, I'd say regarding the frequency, is still very much under debate. I was actually part of a paper that's currently, it's not quite out, but it should be published soon, that was looking at changes in tropical cyclone frequency in a very high resolution global climate model. And interestingly, it suggests, and this is a global climate model that can simulate tropical cyclones up to Category 5, which is previously climate models were not capable of doing. In the context of that model, we actually don't see a decrease in frequency of tropical cyclones. We see about the same or a slight increase in frequency and an increase in strength of tropical cyclones, which is all to say that I don't think the right takeaway is that frequency of tropical cyclones is definitely going to increase, but I think there's still a lot of uncertainty regarding how the frequency of tropical cyclones will change. And I think this is an important challenge to try to understand this question better for adaptation to our changing climate.
Thanks for that insight. Well, returning to your new paper on repeating heat waves, my quick research into this topic suggests the first heat wave of the season is the most dangerous. It kills people, especially seniors who seem to be slow to adapt. But I wonder if that'll continue to be true when we get multiple heat waves. Maybe that's going to be the real danger as the world warms.
Yeah, so you're hitting on the question that's currently causing me headaches. So I've recently been trying to follow up on my paper, which the paper that was recently published focused primarily on the physical hazard of heat waves, meaning we were looking at temperature. We didn't actually look at mortality data very quantitatively. We looked at some past historical heat waves and how much mortality they caused, but we didn't directly try to relate compound heat wave events in a very rigorous quantitative fashion to mortality. And there are actually pretty complex effects that heat waves have on mortality for the following reasons. So there's a population of people that tends to be most susceptible to perishing during heat waves, as we discussed, the old, the sick, individuals who live alone. And what seems to happen during extremely hot days is there'll be a spike in mortality on that extremely hot day, so more people are dying due to the extremely hot weather. But then sometimes in the days following, you actually see a decrease in mortality. And so what that suggests is that there's some finite pool of people that are really at risk for heat waves. And it's possible that if they perish in an initial heat wave because they wouldn't be around anymore, then you might actually see decreased mortality to a subsequent heat wave. In the converse, it's also possible that you have an initial heat wave and that kind of heats up buildings and overwhelms emergency systems such that a subsequent heat wave would have greater effects. So that's the current question I'm actually grappling with, is trying to understand, do we expect the impacts of these compound heat waves to add linearly, or do we expect two heat waves occurring in sequence, the second one to have greater impacts than the first one, or the second one to have reduce impacts compared to the first one because of this kind of displaced mortality effect. So the result you were talking about, where heat waves early in the season seem to have the biggest impact, there's debate about what the reason, the mechanisms behind that result is. One possibility is that people do adapt. Another possibility is that we're seeing some of this mortality displacement effect. So it's intellectually interesting, but it's troubling how much there's definitely still a lot to understand about how temperature impacts mortality. And the field is making a lot of progress in this direction right now. It's evolved a ton since, say, 2008, when temperature and mortality was just not a field that was studied very closely. But I think there's still a lot to learn.
Yeah, in the 1900s, people didn't even write down if people were killed by heat. They just put down heart attack or stroke or something. So here's a question that I ask most of my scientists towards the end of the interview, and it's, how are you concerned personally with climate change, and does what you know sometimes bother you?
Yes, I am concerned personally with climate change. So I got involved in this field in sort of an unusual way. Most people who end up being atmospheric scientists, I found, have physics or math backgrounds. I actually started out studying environmental policy in college, and I was pretty involved in some advocacy for Massachusetts to have cleaner electricity. But as I was involved in that advocacy, I realized that I'm the kind of person that if you ask me a question about, say, how tropical cyclones are going to change, I tend to get very mired in the whys and the details in answer to the question. So that led me to become a scientist. But trying to do something constructive to help people adapt to this issue we're facing is something that's definitely at the top of my mind when I'm doing my research. I think there are some scientists that would say, oh, well, you need to be careful not to be too much of a do-gooder, you know, that could make the work that you're doing biased in some way. But I think it's possible to both. A lot of the work I do is rooted in just intellectual curiosity. I've done some work on the influence of mountains on hurricanes, for example, and we did that because we just thought it was an interesting question, important for basic understanding of the climate system. But then the heat waves paper, for example, I started working on it because I was concerned that this was a risk that was not understood very well in the face of a changing climate. In terms of personal actions, I try to eat mostly vegetarian now, but I have some food intolerances, so sometimes I need to supplement my diet with meat. I always try and find ways to drive less, but that's a bit of a challenge living in suburban New Jersey. But hopefully, always trying to do better in that regard, never perfect.
That's my life entirely. We're trying to do better, but never perfect. And I have to speak up for doing good. I think we should just keep on aiming for that. We have been speaking with Jane Wilson Baldwin from the Princeton Environmental Institute. You can find links to the paper that we've been talking about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jane, thank you so much for sharing with us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was great.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.